Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's January 18th, 2013. You're listening to the finest podcast, PokerCast, any kind of cast there is in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. So we're even finer than a Stratocaster?
Absolutely.
I don't know about that. What about a cast iron skillet? No way we're better than that.
Oh, about a forecast? Are we better than a forecast?
Yeah, we're usually better than most forecasts. That one will win.
We're the best cast out there. With the best
Certainly
cast.
Better than the late night newscast.
That's right.
You know, I don't watch a lot of TV news, but every time it's on in the background sometime, and I have, we'll get right into poker here, I promise, but I'm pretty sure that network, local TV news exists only to scare the bejeebies out of old people.
You know, that's a pretty good assessment.
Because there's nothing on there but who shot who that night, what restaurant has cockroaches running around in it, who's trying to scam you.
Yeah, who's bilking you out of your money, that's right.
There's no real news on it. It's just, oh my God, don't ever leave your house. And oh my God, if you're in your house, you're going to be eaten by bed bugs.
And they're running out of flu shots.
Yeah, I was just reminded of that this week, because I, you know, hanging out with my parents, we went out for the day, and then, you know, my mom made something, some kind of like, oh, is that the hotel where that lady was found dead? I saw that on the news. And I'm like, oh gosh. Sure it's not, but yes, people die, Mom. Doesn't mean I can stop going to hotels.
What's driving me crazy lately with my parents is that they're, like, they'll miss, like, one word in something and then be convinced that the rest of the statement is now what they thought. Even though how crazy it could be, that statement is now true, even though they didn't hear the word not somewhere in there. And then I have to show them, like, 100 different entries online that says, look, see, it's not what you thought it was, or... And that stuff's just driving me crazy. And so, you know, the local news, they prey on that. That's why they kind of mumble when they do the newscasts, too, because they want you to not really understand what's going on. I'd be totally freaked out by it.
Yeah, there's Facebook this morning, too. I saw my old man actually reposted somebody else's crazy post about how Facebook's going to a membership plan now. And part of the line in it was, it's true, it was on the news. Of course, it's not true, and it wasn't on the news, and the post was in all caps, and...
And the 21st version, century version of that is, it's true, it's on the internet.
Yeah.
You've seen that commercial, right, for State Farm, yeah. Right? The girl's like, yeah, I saw it on the internet, it must be true, and then the guy's a French model, walks up to her, it's pretty funny.
All right, let's talk about some poker here. While I'm not watching TV news at night, I try to catch up on some... poker programming. I don't watch the playing poker, you know, and people know that, right? But
right.
But if there's a special on poker or some kind of documentary, then I'm going to tune in if I can. And our good friend Tom Turley mentioned a couple weeks ago that there was a show called Inside Underground Poker on, of all channels, the National Geographic Channel.
Huh.
Because, you know, when I think about getting into the underbelly of the poker world, I think of National Geographic.
Here we witness the lag in his normal environment. The loose aggressive player, otherwise known, likes to sit in the one seat. I mean, really, what is it doing on National Geographic? It's crazy.
I can only think, after watching it, and I'm not trying to be too critical of the people who did it, because it was a good attempt.
Okay.
But my guess is they probably were just shopping it wherever they could, and National Geographic, hey, we got an opening at 3 a.m. tonight. We'll take it. But yeah, so he mentioned this to me about a month ago, and it's been, you know, growing mold on my DVR. Finally got around to watch it last night. And so here's kind of the thing. First of all, they probably blew about 95% of their budget. hiring Michael Imperioli to narrate it.
Oh, jeez.
And he really only narrated for, like, the first 5-10 minutes. And then after that, you never heard of him again. So, you know, maybe that second check bounced, and they're like, all right, we'll just cut that crap out. We don't need a narrator for the second half. But, of course, you know, it gives it that mob kind of feel, you know. And so, anyhow, it's essentially, you know, like all these TV shows, it's the name's a little of a misnomer, right?
Yeah.
You really think you're going to get this, like, look at underground poker, and it's based in New York City, right, where all these underground rooms are and running fairly without impunity, right?
Yeah.
But no, it's just following this one guy, Mikey Tats.
Tats.
Who has a home game that he keeps moving around to keep the pressure off from the 5-0. beginning of the show is in Staten Island, and then he needed to find a new place, went to Brooklyn, didn't like that place. It wasn't the kind of game he wanted to run, but he ran it there. And then finally he found a spot in Manhattan. And now life is looking good. He's like, this is where my game needs to be, the big city. So, I mean, it was interesting, but I've always craved knowledge about the true New York underground. You know, like the Mayfair Club, all these places that we hear about all the time. You know, what's life like in those? I mean, obviously we've seen Founders. I don't know if you've seen that movie ever, but... So you got a kind of like a fictional idea of it. But, I mean, that's kind of what I was looking for. This, not really this Mikey Tats running, you know, picking his dime poker chips up and running from one borough to the next with all these characters.
Yeah.
So it was entertaining for what it was, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
So given that it's on the National Geographic Channel, is the obvious spinoff going to be Mutual of Omaha's Look at Pot Limit Omaha?
Ah, I like it. Very nice. And that little eagle flying by.
That's right. But, you know, you're right. I mean, that's the last thing we need, first of all, is a mob host and underground and Breezy and Banker and Joey the Mush and, you know, Joe Bag of Donuts and all these people. You know what I mean? We really don't need these people representing our game for us. It's hard enough to get out of the back rooms and the bars and everything that we finally did, and now it's like they're trying to drag it back down and, you know, oh, there are machine guns on the roof of the building. And we don't need that. We just need you to look at the positive side of poker.
Yeah, clearly, what we talked about at the front of the show, I'm worried about my parents seeing the show.
Yeah, me too.
This is what we cover for a living, is Mikey Tats and Joey the Moosh.
The Moosh.
You know, because they brought it to such a dramatic conclusion too at the end, you know. Mikey Tats finally made it the big time. He had a game in Manhattan, and this is where my game needs to be. And then they're like, do you ever worry that the law's going to catch up to you, that you're going to go to jail? And then, you know, this long pause, you know, like we're on 60 freaking minutes or something.
Yeah.
No. No, I don't.
Brilliant journalism, asking yes or no questions.
Oh, my gosh. But here's the thing, I mean, and I'm going to, like, you know, hopeful that our New York listeners that play in probably games that are a little bit more professional than Mikey Tats' game will write in and let us know here. But one of the funny things I thought was, you know, he made it clear, of course, this is a show, right? So he's not going to, like, you know, oh, yeah, I knock kneecaps off for a living and stuff, you know. But, you know, he made it clear that he makes his money off of tips. You know, he sets up the game, he scouts the location. He provides security, and of course we saw a fight. You know, you have to have that obligatory fight, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A little punk kid that doesn't know what he's doing. And drinks and food, and brings this massage therapist in wearing a Catwoman outfit or something crazy like that. And at the end of the night, you know, they're cashing out, and I guess these people just throw him a couple bones, right?
Yeah.
That's how it makes his living on this.
Right, right.
So they certainly didn't insinuate there was any rake being taken. So I'm curious, you know, if there's no rake being taken, I mean, I know how the laws are in Florida, technically that game would still be illegal down here, but, if you're not taking any rake, I think it's a little less likely that the 5-0 is going to be all over you, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because you're not, you know, they don't
just providing a service.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. That's all you're doing is providing a service. So I don't know. And the other thing too is the amount of money that's being exchanged at these games. That's the big thing. You know, if you're playing a couple $100 or nickel dime or whatever, it less of a chance that anything's going to happen. But you know, if you're looking at $30,000 or $40,000 buy-ins or something like that, then there's a chance that there could be crime there, and that's what they're trying to avoid.
Oh yeah, I mean these people were cashing out $6,000-$7,000.
Yeah, that's
and they had a little graphic on the screen too. Breezy plus $4,500 tonight. It was even funnier about the end. You know, do you worry about the law enforcement? No, I do not.
No.
Well, you're on a freaking TV show. I know it's National Geographic, so only 7 people are going to see it, but. I mean, you really think your average New York City police officer is unable to track down Mikey Tass after seeing you on the show?
Yeah, maybe it's all fake. I mean, a lot of these reality shows now, they're totally, I mean, they're almost all phony. Even those, like, Pawn Stars guys and all those shows, the Storage Wars, they're putting valuable stuff in the thing intentionally to make you think, oh my God, I really found this priceless Renoir. No, 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 we put it in there for you, and we didn't tell anybody, and we filmed it that way. Because that's what's going on. They're being sued for that. Then it's all fake. So this whole game could be phony.
Yeah, well, you know, and I try not to be too critical of this, because I don't really know. But, I mean, I was watching the whole thing. I'm like, seriously, is this really going on?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Guy's getting a little out of line. Oh, he's got, yep, there's the fight.
But did they actually come to blows? Did anybody actually put their fist against
his face?
Yeah,
they had the security guy that had to push him down, take him out, and then Mikey Tass was like, you need to be out there and watch it, because that guy might be coming back. He's bad news. We don't need this kind of thing in my game.
Joey the Mush don't stand for that.
And tell the security guard, all right, when these people come in through this gate, I want you to frisk them. I don't care whether they have a suit on or not. You frisk them. The big thing is we got to worry about the knives. That's what people bring in here, knives. We can't have knives in my game. And really, I mean, it's all is going back and forth. You have all these people that were on the camera. I mean, no one had their full name or anything, but, you know, the one guy is supposedly his big Wall Street banker. He gets his hair cut every day, has an assistant that answers the phone. Hey, Mikey's got the game tonight. Tell him I'm busy. I'm getting my hair cut. I don't know. I mean, it did seem a little over the top for me. But then again, no offense to all of our friends up in that New York, New Jersey, but your lives in general are over the top for me. I think it's pretty entertaining, just like my Midwestern life is probably incredibly boring to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, we promised our listeners that we would get to poker. I don't think we succeeded with that one there. I think we need to turn our attention to some more actual
poker. That's only National Geographic's fault, not ours.
But, you know, this has been a long time coming. I felt like this should have happened a lot earlier than it did, but the PPA now admits that federal online regulation is so far away that they need to focus on intrastate opportunities. And, you know, they interviewed, what's his name, the PPA guy, Pappas, yeah. John Pappas, and they talked to him a little bit about it. And I'm not surprised by this news at all, to be honest with you, because these states are going out on a limb and doing it on their own, and they need the help. They're the ones that they're trying to do it. So why don't you help them? Because apparently no one is trying, other than Harry Reid and John Kyle. And John Kyle's gone or whatever, and going. And so is Harry Reid. They're all going, right? Aren't they leaving eventually? So,
well, Kyle's already.
Yeah, Kyle's gone, and Reid's leaving. So really, we really have nobody in our corner on the federal level anyway. So PPA should have done this, I thought, even earlier than this, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's I don't want to say that they were behind on this. I think they were very strategic in what they were doing. I mean, they really saw an opportunity to get this federal thing through in the past year, and certainly in the lame duck. But they're a realist. They knew going into the lame duck that if it wasn't going to work out, then really it was going to be a very tough uphill battle. It doesn't mean you don't fight those tough uphill battles, but when you've got another battle that's a little easier, then you shift your attention and resources there. And I think you made it clear, too, that, I mean, obviously they still prefer federal regulation, and, you know, if circumstances change, they're at the ready to go after that. But, yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, if you're a player that wants to play online poker in the United States, I think what you need to do now is really support these efforts that we see in Nevada now, where they're trying to get, you know, the governor approval to enter into compacts with other states. and we'll just piece together this thing state by state. And I guarantee you, if Nevada gets up and running and they get Delaware and New Jersey linked into that thing, that all of a sudden it's going to be like dominoes falling, and then you're going to get a bunch of other states in there. And it might end up being better than the federal bill that we were pushing for right now. It's just going to take a lot more time.
Yeah, if you want to use an analogy, maybe you use the poker analogy, in that when you're playing in a tournament, you don't go all in every single hand to try to win that tournament.
Yeah.
You try to pick off a few chips from the person in a 2-seat, you try to pick off a few from the 3-seat, maybe a bigger chunk in the 6-seat, the bigger chunk being Nevada, because it's a much larger gaming state, so you're getting a lot of reward for that. And then Delaware and New Jersey are, you know, smaller but just as important. And Iowa, even Iowa tried a few times to get it through. Maybe they'll get that through again. Who knows? And California's reintroducing things. So, you know, that way you start gaining more chips from all around the country. Eventually you've got this stack in front of you, and then you can go after the big thing. So maybe, you know, that's the way to do it. Then you turn your attention to the federal and you say, hey, look what's going on here. We have 5 states now playing online poker legally. 5 states or whatever it is, and you guys still won't address this. This is money you're losing, money you're not getting, and we're going to have this hodgepodge sort of regulation out there, and we shouldn't have that with our citizens. We want our country to have safe, regulated, consistent, you know, whatever, and that's the way to go, maybe. And I know you didn't want to say that they came in too late on this, but I feel like they did. I feel like as long as states were out there doing it, they should have been helping it, because our main goal is to get online poker back and regulated. Yes, federal is the ultimate goal, but the main goal is still to get online poker and get it back and get it regulated and get people who can't leave their homes but want to play poker competitively to be able to do that. And I think that's what was missing here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's also, I mean, the situation we're in now, I think PPA's got their back against the wall on this. And the reason I say I didn't think they were late is because I think they understand kind of their risk here. I mean, right now we're talking about if we can get the states linked together in a compact, and it's the second of 3 options for online poker. It's the second best one. I mean, yeah. The best one obviously is federal, and this one, the third one though, is if the states can't work together, and there's a real, very real possibility of that, I believe, and that's the last thing you want, because that's when you're going to start getting 5, 10, 20, 30 different online poker apparatuses and 7 players on each of them, divided up by 7 operators in each. So, you know, you get online and you're playing a 1-person sit and go every night. And I think that's what they're worried about. So I would hope that going forward, the push is really on these compacts and trying to get the states to play together nicely. But they made the point too, is once you get to that point, then it trumps the federal regulation. At that point, there's just not going to be any way for the federal government to come in and take it over at that point.
Yeah. You've got
10 or 15 states that have already had an agreement and doing something. They're certainly not going to. They're going to be like, hey, where were you?
Yep. Well, that's why I'm hoping that if you get just a small enough approved, that it prompts a federal outburst in doing it all. Because, like you said, if it gets past a certain point, federal's going to look at it and say, well, we can't get our money now because, you know, state usurps it, and they're going to be, you know, basically out in the cold. So, yeah, I'm hoping that a couple of states pass it. It prompts them to say, holy cow, let's get on this before it's too late, and then they do it. That's what I'm hoping happens, and we'll see.
Well, what I'm hoping is going to happen is someone actually calls the hotline. 813-448-1120. We'd love to have some of their voices. No one wants to hear my screechy voice and your deep baritone voice all show, right? So,
no.
So call the hotline again one more time in case you'd never heard that number, 813-448-1120. And we'll use the show and give you something great. Like we're going to send Rocco, our mailbag guy, this week. And I know you jumped right in and answered him. Here's what Rocco said. I moved from New York to Georgia for a new job, but after 6 months of no air conditioning, I am in shock and desperation is setting in. That's pretty hardcore. You can't get AC.
Yeah.
Could I fly to Vegas and get a P.O. box to open an online poker account and play in live cash games? I use Bank of America, Worldwide Bank, so that should solve the banking problem, but I'm worried about residency. Would a P.O. box work?
You know, you're right. As soon as this came over, I did immediately answer him. And what I said was, it really has nothing to do with your address. You know, when you set it up, they'll probably use that as their first security question, you know, where do you live or where's your address? One, they may not even accept P.O. boxes, too, by the way. But even if they accepted that, the real problem is going to be your ISP, your IP address. When your address goes to that system, the first thing the security is going to look at is, where is this person playing from? And it'll know instantly that just by your address. You ever notice when you're on your smartphone or your iPad or your tablet or whatever you want to call those things, and it says, do you want this app to allow you to for location stuff? And you'll be like, allow or don't allow these notifications. And if you hit allow, it's because it knows where you are. And so then it'll start sending you local ads on your app or on your whatever you're searching for. So when you're on Google and you search on Google for, let's say, hardware, boom, your Home Depot comes up on your screen. Your local closest one to you Home Depot. How did it do that? Was it just a random lucky thing? No. It knows your IP address. It knows where you are at that moment and knows where you're tapped in. So by sitting in Georgia, just because you have a P.O. box, when you log on, it instantly knows you can't play there because you're not living there. You're not in that address state. So, and the other thing, too, is there is, for the really computer savvy people, there is a way around this, and I don't want to say what it is particularly because I don't know the specifics of it, but there are ways to remotely play things where if you have someone in that state, you can have them have the software on their computer and you have the software on your computer, and then you're playing through their computer. So you would have to literally arrange. It would take a lot of arranging and logistics and say, hey, Joe, I want to play online poker. Can you turn your computer on for me? But it is possible. I think when I was out in Vegas, a friend of mine out there told me about that. He was saying that, you know, he has a friend that lives in England. Or not England, but yeah, it may have been England. And they were playing because they couldn't play here. So he would call his, or you know, Skype his friend in England and say, hey, I want to play a few hands on party poker or whatever it is, and was doing it. And I don't recall the specific way of doing it, but there is a way to do it. But the way he wanted to do it, no. So
yeah, I think Chloe in 24 rigged that up for Jack Bauer once.
There you go. I mean, it takes some serious effort and whatever, but I there could be, and even that, they may be able to stop. So I wouldn't give that. That's a lot of effort. But the P.O. box definitely won't work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to actually be in the state. And so, I mean, I guess my question for Rocco is, I don't know, his job's not working out, but just move to Vegas.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to worry about it.
From one hot climate to another.
I mean, at least this time of year, you don't need to worry about AC in Vegas.
That's right.
And man, I'm having to pack parkas for the trip out to the Red Rock next week. Yeah. Can't believe that most of the time I'm out there with you, I'm walking down the strip in jeans in 197 degree weather.
You know, I was thinking about that today too, because I remember when I went out for the November 9 the second time, and it was November, and I walked out the back entrance of the Rio, and I absolutely could not stop my teeth from chattering, and my arms were actually shaking. It was so cold, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And all I had to do was run from the Rio to my car in the back lot where they have the, you know, the valet. And it was uncontrollable. I could not stop. I'm like imitating it right now. I could not stop my hands and my arms and my teeth from moving. I physically couldn't do it. No matter how hard I concentrated, it was that cold. And I thought, God, I've lived in Florida way too long, you know.
Well, isn't it crazy? There are people like places like that that can be the extremes.
Mm.
Are crazy. I mean, yeah. I've been out in Vegas in December too when we planned our wedding, and we were exactly the same way you were, like, no one told me it gets cold out here.
Or at least that cold. I mean, yeah. it was involuntary, these movements I was making. It was hilarious. If somebody had a camera on me, they'd have thought I was like dancing or having a conniption, one or the other. It was hilarious.
So, Rocco, you move out during the winter. Don't worry about the AC. You make bank there, and then you head back to Georgia and enjoy the summer.
With no air conditioning.
With no air conditioning, yeah. That's what you need to do. But no, you cannot play from Georgia in Vegas. Sorry,
right.
Man.
Sorry, man.
But the good news is we're going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You can listen, you can play that wherever you are.
That's right.
And you don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store and send us your mailbag questions and call the floors to podcast@andyupmagazine.com. And we, you too, might get something great. And particularly call the floors. No one, apparently all the dealers and floor people are doing fantastic jobs, Chris, because we haven't had a call the floor here in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and that's not surprising. These guys work hard. They're quality. They're trained well. It's not surprising.
Maybe because the call the floor segment has been so useful.
We've turned all the problems around.
That we've actually put Jody Russell out of a job.
Well, you know, you brought up Red Rock before. One of the things I want to say is that, you know, the Antioch Poker Tour is at the Red Rock Casino Resort and Spa, January 21st to 27th. Now, Scott's going to be there, but Scott, what days are you going to be there? Because that's a long gap. Are you going to be there for all those days or not?
I'm actually going to be there for the entire thing.
So he's going to be there from the 21st to the 27th. So you can show up whenever you want. Scott will be there bleary-eyed and gray-haired, waiting for you to come by and wrap him on the back and say, hey, man, it's okay. I'm sorry you watched that National Geographic show. There's better stuff on TV. Let me tell you all about it. So go out there and meet Scott. Hey, play in one of the events. Play in the main event. Try to get on the cover of Antioch Magazine. And if you want to stay there, we got special Antioch room rates of $89. More details of all of our Antioch Poker Tour events can be found at antiochpokertour.com.
Yeah, I'm starting to hear a bunch of people are going to be out there, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool.
And again, if folks haven't gone to antiochpokertour.com and checked out the schedule, I think you will. I mean, I'm looking forward to playing a lot more events than I normally would in these places. They got a couple tournaments running. They're only $40.
Yeah.
With $10 rebuys. I think those are going to be a blast. And I'm hoping I can make it to the Heads Up event. They're cutting that off at 32 players, but I'm craving that event. I would love to play that one.
Because you like to get your butt spanked in one round.
Exactly. I like to be in and out of a tournament in 5 minutes.
You want to be the first one out.
Yeah, because then I can enter the Omaha event, which is going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Yeah, but no, I mean, a lot of great stuff going on, and it's certainly affordable. I mean, really, I mean, a $40 tournament for Player of the Year points, can't beat that. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Say, yeah. And then, of course, if you can't make it out to Vegas, or even if you can, consider planning a nice, wonderful family poker vacation this year to the Hard Rock Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic, which is now accepting bookings for our Antioch Poker Tour World Championship event July 28th to August 3rd at the luxurious all-inclusive resort. That means everything's included. 14 tournaments with buy-ins as low as $100, with the winner of the $1,100 main event appearing on the cover of Antioch Magazine. Great all-inclusive room rates for adults and children will make this a great poker and or family vacation this year. More information at antiochmagazine.com/world championship, including how you can win your way there at Dover Downs and now Thunder Valley Casino and Resort.
Yes, and when we say all-inclusive, we mean food, drink, credits in the on the resort property. I mean, there's just so much for this price. You can't afford to miss this. I'm sorry, you really can't. It's absolutely incredible. Try to figure that vacation out, and you'll know you're having a good deal. And speaking of vacation, Jonathan Little's going to be our pro on our February 4th cruise coming up real quick, Port Canaveral, Florida. And as we say every week, we're past our rate guarantee. So you want to book as soon as you can so we can still get you on as cheap as possible.
Still making bookings.
Yeah, and we're still
four more people.
The poker world is hilarious. We are still booking people 2.5 weeks out. But you know, the rest of this year, too, we're sailing out of Miami, getting some people giving away stuff at Miami, which is great. New York City and Tampa. Get all the details, including how you can win your way on board at Dover Downs again, Daytona Beach Kennel Club, Seneca Salamanca, and now Naples Fort Myers Greyhound Track. At AntiochCruises.com. Very exciting stuff.
Very nice.
Okay, Scott, let's hit the Antioch News Desk.
Daniel Negreanu has been tapped to redesign the Heartland Poker Tour structures heading into the tour's next season. Among the changes are introducing antes in Level 4 just to piss off Chris Cosenza. but no, actually, they say just for action. And an overall structure designed to crown a champion in 25 hours.
Yes. Well, can you spur more action with just bigger blinds at that level, too? I think you could. Same amount of money in the middle, just not having to bother 10 people to do it. Okay, so also, Dan Negreanu, to go with his new gig at Heartland Poker Tour, apparently has found a new date. He is featured on a recent episode of Millionaire Matchmaker, yet another reality show about poker, somehow. After learning he needs to talk less about himself and apparently found a compatible match in a blonde named Lindsay. Interesting. You know, I watched that Millionaire Matchmaker once before, and it had the shoe lady on there.
Oh, Beth Shack, yeah.
Yeah, Beth Shack, and that was more of a publicity thing than anything. It didn't seem like she was really interested in anybody at that
time. So if they put Beth Shack together with Danny Negreanu, it'd be $2 million matchmaker, right?
It'd be multi-million dollar
match. Why don't you just cut out these gold diggers out of this show and just put the millionaires together?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Ooh. They at least have poker in common, right?
They have poker in common. Probably some other things.
I didn't watch this, so I don't know whether Daniel has anything in common with this Lindsay woman.
They have blonde highlights.
Apparently they smooched and stuff, so, you know, ooh, there's a love connection there.
Cool. But, hey, I'm happy for him, man. He's got good things going on in his life, so good for him.
And finally, Sergio Hernandez, a college student who has been offered a scholarship to Georgetown University, has been sentenced to 60 years in prison. That's not a mistypo. 60 years for an armed robbery of a home poker game. He must serve at least 5 years of the sentence and will be eligible for parole in 30 years.
So he used to have a scholarship offer from Georgetown. Now he has an offer from Attica. And that's 6-0, by the way. 6-0. 60 years. See, we need to get this guy together with Mikey Tatz.
Yes.
Maybe this guy robbed Mikey Tatz's game. Who knows?
Could have been, yes. You know, he's always on the run looking for a new location, so.
What I find interesting, this would be a real twist, is the guy robs the home game, and the guys in the home game were all sentenced to prison, too, because they're playing an illegal home game.
Like, sure as hell, that would be an awesome sitcom. Coming to NBC this fall.
Yep. You broke the law by stopping us from breaking the law. I want you to go to prison. Well, you got to come with me because you broke the law, too. I mean, how do you report that crime? You know, it's kind of like street justice, you know?
Yeah, it's like the guy that called the cops, hey, somebody ripped off my marijuana.
Yeah, my pa, exactly.
What's your address, sir? We'll be right out.
I think that's actually one of those headlines I've seen on Jay Leno's show.
That actually happened in Ohio when I lived there. I'm like, I got to get out of this city, man.
Drug dealer reports theft of his drugs. More details at 11. Scaring all the senior citizens in your area.
But in all serious, 60 years.
Yeah, that's a long time.
That may be, other than outside of life in prison, I don't think I've heard of a 60-year prison sentence ever.
Yeah, that's kind of a weird number. Maybe it was...
And I'm not saying it should be taken lightly. I mean, they robbed these people. Apparently, they pistol-whipped them. They made them take their pants off. They stole their phones and stuff. And that's what the judge said is, you know, hey, we got to send a
message.
A message that this kind of behavior is not tolerated. I don't know whether anybody's listening or not, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, he humiliated him on top of it. And armed robbery, I mean, when you do armed robbery in Florida, isn't it like you get life no matter what? What is that big poster they had up all the time on the billboards?
I don't know. It's been quite a while since I've participated in armed robbery.
Yeah, I know, but there was a big billboard. It's like, you know, a gun gets you 25, but then something else gets you life, or, I don't know, second offense is life or whatever. So... You know, you probably pistol whipped seven guys in a home game. You deserve a lot more than just, 25 years. So, very interesting. Okay, hey, we got a brand new O'Malley's Move this week, so very excited. Let's get to it.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are sitting at a 2-5 no limit hold'em cash game. The table is full of a lot of young, aggressive players who know the game well, and it shows in their play. The standard raise has been to 3x big blind all night. We look down at the ace of clubs, king of clubs, in the under-the-gun position. Oh, great. But there are some things we have going for us. We're at about hour two of the session, and at the one-hour mark, we made a great read for all of our chips and doubled up. We also won a few more pots, and we now sit with 1,300. Our play and image has made some opponents fear us, even with our average stack. We've been able to raise and take it a few times pre-flop. However, we sense our opponents are getting frustrated with our aggression pre-flop, and we may have gotten somewhat of a target on our back. With a suited ace-king, we're going to raise it up. But since it's from the under the gun, with eight players to act behind us, we're going to make them pay. We raise it 5x to $25, Perhaps this is a mistake. I guess we'll find out. It's folded around to the MP, who takes a bit of time before putting in a call. He's a young, aggressive player, but solid. He's got about 900. It then gets folded around to the button, who also calls. He's a bit older, and has had to rebuy twice. However, neither time was because of poor play on his part. Both were suckouts. He's a solid player, too. What are we doing at this table? He's got about 1,200. The blinds fold, and the flop comes the ace of spades, nine of diamonds, four of diamonds. Now, while we don't like the diamonds, we couldn't ask for much more than top-top. We've got to lead out at this. With $75 in the pot, max rake achieved already, we lead out for $55. The MP thinks for quite a while before putting in a call, and the button calls relatively quickly. Yikes. The turn is the 10 of clubs, somewhat meaningless, and we're put to our first decision. Are we putting in another bet with two to act behind us? With 240 in the pot and now less than 1,200 in front of us, nah. We're gonna exercise some pot control. We check. The MP thinks for a time before counting out 100 and putting that into the pot. What's this about? What's worse, the button calls. We might be in a bind here. But with 440 in the pot and only needing another 100 to call, what can we do? We put in the call, and the 10 of spades comes off on the river. That's bad, right? We check, and the MP carefully puts 250 into the pot. The button instamucks, and now we've got a decision. If we call and win, we've had a great session. Call and lose, we dip down to about 800, which is still a profit. However, if we fold, we still have more than double our original buy-in. Is there a case for raising? But this is where you come in. What are we going to do?
Chris, over the past couple months, we've gotten a couple emails from listeners asking us to detail some of the key differences between cash games and tournaments. And we also have a growing post on the Anti-Up Magazine forum at antiupmagazine.com/forum about the same thing. And it's been a while since we've actually gotten into some kind of a strategy kind of talk. We've been busy, you know, with travels and interviews and things like that. So, yep. Kind of going old school today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like this kind of stuff because I actually learn things when we do this. It's not just me pontificating on stuff that the average poker player, you know, fails at. It's you having your point of view, and I learn how you think about things too. And not that I want to take advantage of that in the home game or anything, but I mean, it's stuff that I may not have thought of. So that's why I enjoy this a lot, because I don't think of things sometimes the way you do, and vice versa. So it helps me with my game as well.
Oh yeah, that's great. And I hope I like to see that a lot of our listeners pop into the forum too and jump into that thread that's going on and really take this to another level, because that's one of the weaknesses of the PokerCast. I was talking to somebody this week, and they're like, who hadn't even heard of it, and was trying to understand it. I'm like, so is it live? Can people call in? And I'm like, no, they can't. But we have this great hotline that no one uses, but they can call it, and we'll put them on, and it sounds like a show. That's great. But you know, this is kind of a discussion that I like to see spill out and spread.
Absolutely,
with other points of view, because we certainly are not the end all be all of anything. Other than
mediocrity
ramblings at the top of the show.
Yeah. Mediocrity.
all right. Well, I put together what I'm calling some macro kind of considerations, and then I know you're going to follow up. You have some actual strategy considerations after that. But I'll kick it off here with just saying time considerations. You know, obviously, when you enter a tournament, you can't control how long you'll play, as you do with cash games. So I guess this, it seems extremely obvious, but I think you have to be mentally prepared for the effects of that. You know, if you sit down in a cash game and within 30 minutes you just aren't quote-unquote feeling it, you could get up, pick your stack up, and go home, and no harm, no foul. But in a tournament, if you do that, you're not picking up anything other than the coaster for your drink. You know, you're out. So, yeah. I've done this more often than I'd like. I've entered tournaments when I wasn't mentally prepared for the length of it. You know, like, particularly back in the online days, I don't know if you did it too, but, you know, It's late at night. I finished work. All right, I'm going to jump into a tournament. What's going on? Oh, hey, there's one starting right now. Boom. Next thing I know, 4 hours into it, I'm like, you know, I got toothpicks on my eyes like in the old cartoons. And I'm like, what was I thinking 4 hours ago? And the answer was I wasn't thinking.
Yeah, that's where it's happened most to me. I can recall playing at 4:30 in the morning because I went deep in a 2,200-player tournament and I make the final table, and it's 4:30 a.m., and I'm like, what was I thinking? I got to work in 3 hours, you know, or whatever. This is so stupid. And yeah, that's exactly right. If I was playing cash, I'd have quit at midnight.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can get in, get out of cash, and so I think there's a lot of advantages to that. I mean, you know, the tournament does lock you up for a while, and I don't think a lot of people actually... I mean, I'm not saying they don't think of that. I think when they enter, they know, hey, this tournament's probably going to take 4 hours, but I don't think they've actually mentally prepared themselves for playing for 4 hours.
And when you're online, when that finally does come back, I mean, there's really no way to know how long you're going to be playing online because, you know, you're sitting there and you register for a tournament, all of a sudden there's 2,200 people registered for that tournament. If you go deep, you'll be there 10, 12 hours.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it just can't happen. And one of the people who that really come down, not hard on tournaments, but really pro for cash games is Jennifer Harmon, you know, another poker reality person. Yeah. She always says, you know, I like cash games because I can go and pick up my kids from the school, or I can, you know, go to the doctor's office when I need a treatment or something like that. And when it comes to, tournaments, it's like, okay, sorry, I can't pick up my kids from school, or I can't do this because I'm stuck here for 10 hours. So, that's one of the main reasons why I don't like tournaments.
Well, you know, a lot of these are going to sound obvious. The next one I had down was table selection. I mean, tournaments, you have no say in where you sit, as long as you're in a legitimate tournament.
Yeah.
Some of these fly-by-night events that, hey, just pick a seat, any seat.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't like your table, too bad. But in a cash game, you have the ability to, you know, at the very least, ask for a seat or table change and move around. Or even do a few laps around the room and get a feel for how the table's playing before you sit down and risk even $1. And I think that's something that I don't think you think about a lot. You know, when you enter a tournament, you really, there's no prepping for your opponents that you could do. I mean, you can get yourself in the right mental thing. You can think about playing poker, but you don't. It's a mixed bag who you're going to sit down next to, right?
No, absolutely.
In a cash game, you can actually watch the game that you're going to get in and know your opponents before you sit down, and that gives you an advantage.
Sure does. You also have more things to choose from in cash. Like, you know, you go to a poker room with the intent of playing a tournament. Well, yeah, okay, so you had to pick that tournament. But once you're there, that's the tournament. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a cash game, you can go down there and say, do I feel like 1-2? Boy, that 2-5 looks juicy over there. Or do I feel like, oh my God, they're opening a stud 8 game? Oh my God! I'm sorry, guys. Got to go. You're in a tournament. They open a stud 8 game. I'm stuck in this tournament. You know what I mean? There's just so much more freedom in cash.
Yeah, I'll give you a funny example from my Biloxi trip last week. I can't believe I forgot to tell you this, but you know, when we entered that limit hold'em tournament, which I'll remind folks that we had 27 entries, and about an hour after the tournament started was their daily mega satellite for their main event, and they always guarantee 2 main event seats in that 5 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
So at 4:55, they've been announcing this for half an hour. But 4:55, 5 minutes before they started, they had one entry for the mega, and there was started to be some considerable talk around our limit hold'em table about people getting out of the tournament that we're in and jumping in that one because of the huge overlay.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, if those people were not in the tournament, they would have entered right away. But then you got to think, oh my gosh, I already spent $230 for this tournament. Am I going to spend another $100 over there? And it's going to. So, I mean, it locked you in. As it turned out, I mean, they ended up getting so many people at the last minute in the late registration that they well passed the guarantee and gave out 4 seats instead of 2. So it ended up not being a consideration in the past tense. But yeah, I mean, you find yourself locked in. It's almost like prison.
Yep. Yeah, it's really debilitating. So,
all right. Next on my list was I always like this one. Wealth equalizer. And I use this analogy on the show a lot, but you know, if Bill Gates were to sit down in a cash game, he could own it in short order because he could go all in every hand, and losing him wouldn't hurt anywhere near as much as losing hurts the rest of us. You know, guy's got $50 billion, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not saying going all in is optimal, but, whew, you know, hey, if he loses $2,000 at the local track and falls out of his, I mean, that's like half a split second of work, you know.
Yeah, he sneezes and $2,000 comes out of his nose.
Exactly. But for the rest of us, that could be the difference between paying the mortgage that month, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're in a freeze-out tournament, he is just like the rest of us. When he's out of chips, he's out of luck. Yeah. I mean, we'll get into strategy a little later, but for me, I think remembering that is the big consideration here is bluffing. I think you're much more likely to be called on bluffs in cash games because your opponents know if they're wrong, they can just rebuy.
Right.
In a tournament, once they're out, they're out. So you can get away with that stuff a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And then let's see, hand selection. Obviously, in tournaments, blinds increase every 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 60 minutes, whatever. In a tournament, so eventually a tight player like me will be pushed to panic. In a cash game, it's 1-2 all night long. So it's far less important to mix it up in cash game because of this. While no one advocates simply playing ABC poker, it can be a rather effective strategy in cash games because there's no blind pressure on you to have to be creative.
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
You just sit there and wait for your big hands. I mean, obviously, you would do better if you mixed it up a little bit, but certainly, you know, in a tournament, you're going to be forced to play King Rag at some point or 7-8 suited under the gun just because you've got some pressure to get it in. But
yeah, and I'll touch on that a little bit too. And
really, no reason to do that.
Latter half of the segment.
All right, and then I think this is my last one before we get into the strategy. Value for your money. This is a big one for me. You know, even though it's often less likely that I'll win as much money in a tournament as I would in a cash game, my downside is also mitigated. You know, I usually feel pretty confident that I'll get 3 to 5 hours of enjoyment out of a $60 tournament, whereas I could be down $200 on the first hand of a cash game.
I added something to that, too. One thing to consider is, though, is that you'll need, overall, you'll need less of a bankroll to play cash games. And I said, why? Because you can sit in some cash and win some cash right away and leave. If you play tournaments, generally, you only cash about 10% of the time. So what if you played 10 $100 tournaments and didn't cash until the last one? That's $1,000 you invested. And if you only min cashed, making like $200, you're still down $800. In cash games, if you buy in for $100 and lose it all or win it all, you know, either way, the odds of you having 9 straight losing sessions out of the gate for $100 every single time is far less likely than you losing 9 straight times in tournament poker. So you don't need to have that $1,000 to play 10 sessions. You really only need 100 or 200, depending on how well you play in that first session. So you definitely need a smaller bankroll for cash. You can sit down any moment with cash and play, but if you're going to play consistently in tournaments, you're going to need that big bankroll to for variance.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I say this on the show a lot, and, you know, I'm a recreational player. I mean, I really don't harbor any illusions of ever being a professional player. I mean, I want to improve as I play, but I play poker mostly for fun. And for me, tournaments I enjoy more. And like I said, I mean, it's worth it for me to put $60 into a tournament someday. No, I mean, obviously I can be out the first hand, but that it doesn't really happen usually that often. So I'm gonna get that night of poker for $60. Whereas if it's done a cash game, and you know, obviously I could win $1,000, but I could, you know, lose $200, and that's not as much fun for me. So that's kind of a consideration. You know, are you there for enjoyment first or second? Or if you're there to make money first or second, that kind of would play into which one you decide.
Right. It depends on your bankroll and your time. You know, if you're saving up your money to enter a tournament, you know what I mean, then that's one thing. But if you have sort of a bankroll that you dip into to go play and stuff, and you're doing it consistently, and you're going to play consistently, then yeah, you're right. You need, if you're consistently playing, you need a bigger bankroll for tournaments. But okay, well, my first one was because when I hear people asking me the differences, it's almost always strategy. So I think if you have an edge in a cash game in a particular situation, even a small one, then you're more likely to take it in a cash game because you're playing the odds. You know mathematically, if you do this consistently and correctly, you're going to make money. And if you do lose, you can buy back in. Obviously, in tournaments, sans rebuys and you know, re-entries. If you lose a flip, you're done. Mm-hmm. You know, and like when I think about a lot of the tournaments that I play, when I play, it's usually because I'm making an appearance somewhere that they're asking me to play, so I'm driving or flying. And if I'm in a tournament and I had to drive 2.5 hours to get there, you know, I really don't want to be flipping for my life, especially early on in that tournament. Whereas in a cash thing, I know I drove 2 hours, I know I'm out in 20 minutes or I lost my buy-in, but I'll just reach into my pocket and buy in again so I can play for a little bit longer. So really, the edges are, you know, are taken under consideration in cash games because, you know, if you do it consistently, you're still going to make money on it, whereas in tournaments, it could cost you your entire day. So,
yeah, and I think an important part about it, too, you have to understand, too, is that's only the case if you're willing to reach back in your pocket.
Yeah.
And pull back out. I mean, if you're playing above your means, or, you know, hey, I only have $100 on me today, then that changes your cash game philosophy. You almost have to play it like a tournament at that point. But generally speaking, you shouldn't be sitting down in a cash game unless you're willing to reach back into your wallet, because that takes away some of the advantage of playing cash games.
Yeah, and it doesn't always necessarily mean that it's going to cost you your whole stack whenever you have these edges either. Right. But your chips are actually, ironically, are less valuable in a cash game than they are in a tournament, even though you pay more for the cash game chips, you know, because in this instance, it doesn't mean your life. It does in tournaments. So, and then my next one is strategy two.
The
deuce. When you're playing tournaments, you know, they have you checking the clock when the blinds are going up. Where is the pay increase? What's my M? What's the average stack? How many people are still around? Are we near the bubble? You know, you start thinking about all those things, and there's just so much more to consider, and you're not really focusing on the actual task at hand, which is poker. Cash is cash is cash. When you're playing cash, cash is poker. You're playing poker on that one hand. Yeah, you're setting up other hands later, and you're watching the way people play and everything for situations. But really, you're just worried about the hand at task, right? That moment. Yep. And this sort of is an extension of the edges that I just discussed, because you'll be forced to do all kinds of calculating outside of the actual hand and the game itself when you're in tournaments. You know, and whereas cash, it's simply a calculation. Do I have an edge here? Is this, you know, am I getting the right odds on my money? And that, to me, also leads into my next one, because in tournaments, I call this luck versus skill. In tournaments, players are forced, like you mentioned a little earlier, they're forced to do things that are less optimal, like shove based on stack size and their optimal situation. Mm-hmm. And it takes skill almost completely out of poker at that point. Now you're playing a game of who can get in first to the, you know, into the middle, rather than, okay, I got ace king. If I was in a cash game, I wouldn't shove with $40 in front of me. I would still try to get something out of this. But in a tournament, you know, you're shoving with it because you're hoping to double up. And it's not skill anymore. Yeah, there's some minute skill in there. There's a little bit of skill because you have to know when to shove, and but it's not poker related. It's right. It's an equation that all these brilliant people have sat around and creating the M and everything else. And it's that's where luck comes into play after that. Yeah, okay, in cash, sure, you can be lucky. You can get a lucky turn card or an unlucky turn card that can hurt you and give you a bad beat. But generally, you're not getting it in with any two cards just because you're first to enter a pot in a cash game and you're short. The skill in cash is much greater. You know, also, lucky people who get lucky in a tournament, you know, you're leaving these lesser-skilled players in the tournament just because they got lucky and outflopped you on a 68-32, you know, whatever. And in cash, that's just not going to happen. Hardly ever happens. You know, if you got a pair and you think the guy's shoving with any two, you know, in a tournament, it's a no-brainer sometimes. But in a cash game, you know what? Do I really want to race threes versus, you know, for $20? You know, no. And I guess this one leads into my next one, eliminations. You know, in tournaments, you may take a chance at eliminating a short stack if you have a lot of chips, because it helps your overall goal, and that is to get to the cash bubble, reduce the field, and get some money. But in cash, if I have a very marginal hand and a short stack show, I'm not going to... What am I going to call for? You know, well, I might win $20 from this guy in this one, but now you're reducing my overall stack. If I lose, that's real money. And it doesn't do anything if I eliminate this guy. If I eliminate him, another person's going to sit there, and I'm, you know, he may double up and take my money and leave. So it really does nothing except for putting a couple of bucks in my pocket at that one moment. Plus, the amount that you're guaranteed by knocking out the bubble is much more than what you'd win by knocking out a short stack cash game player. Sure. You know, you're playing 1-2, and the guy's got $22 in front of him, and he shoves, and you look down at deuce-deuce. Yeah, I'll call, whatever. All right, you win $22. Well, you do that in a tournament, and you clear the bubble, and you bought in for $100 in that tournament, you just made $150, $200 guaranteed because of that one call.
That's right.
Because you knocked them out. So there are reasons to call in tournaments that you would never even entertain in cash, you know. And then my last one is immediate satisfaction. In cash games, it gives you a chance to win right away and rewards you for your efforts on a single hand. Whereas tourneys give you a slow, positive reinforcement over the long haul, you know, trying to build your self-esteem and then eventually getting that payoff. Whereas cash games, you can sit down... Yeah, exactly. You know, I like myself and Dosh Garn and people like me or whatever. But really, in cash games, you can sit down, you're like, oh man, I got aces. You know, I played this really well. I played the pot odds right. Boom, look at all this money in front of me now. I just double my buy-in. Whereas it would take you 9 hours to double your buy-in in a tournament. You don't get that immediate satisfaction. So those are the differences that I find and why I've always leaned toward cash games after that initial stint I had where I played just Sit and Goes and MTTs for a while.
Right. And I guess we didn't get into Sit and Goes. We don't really need to get too much into it, but I always found Sit and Goes to be kind of like a mixture of the two. I mean, you get some more of that convenience that you lose in a tournament.
Yes.
You know, because you know you're only going to be in there for an hour or so. So, I was never good at no-limit hold'em cash games. Limit cash games completely different. But back, you know, when we used to play online, that's why I kind of liked the Sit and Go, because it kind of gave me that short attention span theater I needed, but had that extra strategy that we talked about. I guess it's kind of a different way of saying what you said before, too, is that in cash games, I mean, you're using all your strategy on the actual poker elements. Where in tournaments, you have this second subset of strategy that you had to consider in addition to all that poker strategy.
Yes.
And that's why I like the tournaments. But at the same time, you know, if I don't have 4 hours to play, I can't play it. But a Sit and Go gets me in and out in an hour.
Right. It gives you the tournament feel with the cash game clock.
Or there you go.
The cash game time frame. So
put that on a t-shirt.
Would you buy that t-shirt? Let us know at podcast@anyupmagazine.com.
Well, I know we kind of breezed through that, but that was a lot of good stuff, I thought.
I think so, and it wasn't really... I mean, you know, we breezed through it, but, you know, I feel like that's enough time dedicated to it, because some of it's pretty obvious, some of it's, you know, in-depth, but I think people will appreciate it, you know, even those who already know all this stuff. Maybe there's something in there that they didn't think of.
And like I said, obviously, I hope folks jump on the forum at anyupmagazine.com/forum. Find that thread and keep that conversation going, because you know the more people that share their thoughts, the more you learn from it. Just as you said, I mean, you made some real good points that made me think about some stuff that I hadn't thought about. So the more people get in the forum, the better this discussion becomes.
You like me. You really like me.
You like me.
Hey, this is AJ Benzing.
This is Justin Bonomo.
This is Downtown Chad Brown.
Hi, this is Clooney Gallen.
This is Daniel Negreanu.
Hey, this is David Singer.
This is Linda Johnson.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer.
Hi, this is Hoyt Corkins.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet.
Hi, this is John D'Agostino.
This is Joe Seabach.
This is Jennifer Harmon.
Yeah, this is Johnny Chan.
This is Cowboy Kenna James.
Hi, this is Mark Safe.
This is Paul Wasserkin.
Hi, this is Miami Johnson.
This is Dora Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, we got a hand this week from Keith, and I'm not even going to try to butcher his name, but he's a longtime listener. He knows who he is.
Kasperzik.
That might be close.
All right.
Kasperzik. You know, when you get three consonants in a row without a vowel, I don't know what to do there.
I think it's Polish for cash person. Kasperzik.
Could be.
Maybe.
But anyhow, now he's a longtime listener. Now probably certainly not a listener. Now that we just made fun of his name.
We didn't make fun of his name. I didn't.
Polish. Maybe it's not Polish.
Oh, I don't know. I thought that was Polish.
Maybe it's Slovenian.
No, okay.
Or maybe it's just a misspelled Irish name. I don't know. We don't know. The point is, we don't know.
We just don't know.
All right, well, we're going to call him Keith, because that I can pronounce. And look at it. He's like, hope life is good. See, that's a positive way to start the hand of the week.
Cool.
Life is good, by the way, Keith. Thanks for asking. All right, so this is actually an online hand. We don't get many of these. He's one of these folks that is trudging along on Lock Poker.
Ah.
those sites that still services the U.S. market. And it looks like we are in a $15 rebuy tournament.
Okay.
Five players at the table, and he says we're on the final table bubble.
Oh, wow.
But we are in the money already, so we've already cashed. And he says I'm probably 3 or 4 of 10 left. So
right.
I believe we have two hands going here, or two tables left of five each. And it's going to be 1,400 for first place and 1,000 for second, in case we're interested. We've been playing five-handed for 15 hands or so, and the last hand I doubled up when the small blind jammed into me holding ace-ace in the big blind, and we made the call. So about six of the last seven hands, I've seen the under-the-gun raise. And, of course, his first point is this the new button? I think it's the new anti-penultimate.
Pretty good. Close. That was pretty close.
Getting better.
Yeah, you're doing all right.
All right, so our chip stacks under the gun, which is us, 62,000. The cutoff, about 28,000. And the button, 38,000.
Okay.
And then the small blind, which is our hero, about 54,000. And the big blind, who apparently will be the villain, 71,000. Got us outchipped.
Okay.
And in terms of big blinds, we're at 1,000, 2,000 now. So we had 27 big blinds, and our presumed villain has 35 big blinds.
Okay, I just want to preface this by a little caveat that I don't play tournaments. So as we discussed in the main topic today, so take everything I say with a grain of salt.
But you'll be happy to know that there's a 200 ante in this level.
Oh, that's my favorite thing.
But see, you can't complain about it online, right?
No.
Because there's no questioning who paid or not.
No, because it automatically is taken from your stack, and there's no doesn't hold up the game.
Okay, so the big blind in this hand has been described as a very good player who knows what he's doing, profitable and aggressive. Let's see, our under-the-gun player is a decent player. He did see him fold to fairly short, 10 bigs or so, before getting in with ace-queen. He says, last couple of rotations, there's been a lot of under-the-gun raises. I recently doubled the previous hand when one of the opponents shoved a small blind. Okay, we just heard about that. I guess he's just obviously brag.
Okay.
all right, so we have king of spades, queen of clubs, and the small blind. And the under-the-gun player raises to 4,000, and it folds to us.
So
a mid race.
The thing about him mentioning that the under the gun player has raised five hands in a row is he saying that to set this up so that we fail? This is the meta game, you know, that I have to play every week that I don't like to play because ultimately we always end up losing these hands anyway. So, are we saying that the under the gun raise is less valuable or powerful than it has been in normal tournaments or even earlier in the tournament before they reach this final table bubble? Is that what he's trying to tell me so that I can think that my king-queen is probably stronger and would, if I shoved with it, would get respect from this guy? So
this is kind of what I'm going to take from it. Oh, I'm sorry, were you in the middle?
No. Go right ahead, please. Save me from myself.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things I'm thinking about here. One is five-handed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're going to be playing, obviously, your first hit anyhow, basic ABC poker, you should be raising anyhow, right?
Right.
Five-handed, you know, certainly
it's equivalent to a middle position, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we're going to be raising quite a bit. So I don't necessarily think that that's too out of line, that there's been a lot of raising. Obviously, it depends on who's under the gun. But right now, our under the gun is 62. He's second in chips. I would think somebody who's second in chips at a five-handed table is going to be very aggressive at this point. And really put the pressure on those players that he can knock out, right? And try to stay clear of the one guy that can knock him out.
Yes.
So I'm not really putting a lot of credence into anything. I mean, you could be doing this with any two cards whatsoever. So I'm not saying I'm taking all that information he gave us and tossing it in the trash can, but I just don't think it's as valuable in this situation as it would be in a 10-handed second level of tournament.
Okay, I totally agree with that. 100%. And so what I'm thinking is, given the situation that the under-the-gun player in this, for the last five or six hands, no matter who the under-the-gun was, they raised, seems to be this sort of, you know how tables sort of settle in on a sort of a pattern?
Right. Yep.
So, okay, so first of all, if he's thinking that I'm opening with a wider variety of hands because I'm really in middle position, if this is a full ring game, my hand wouldn't have to be that strong. Plus the fact that people have been doing it every time, plus the fact that he's the second largest stack at the table, that lends credence to that the fact that this hand is probably not as strong as my king queen. So
exactly.
I have one big person behind me, the big blind. Now, although the big blind is bigger than me, I'm actually the short stack at this table anyway. So, being the short stack, I think we are, right? No, we're 54.
No. We're
28 to cut.
Well, yes, we're shorter in stack than the one person.
Right. Okay. Right. But we're still.
We are the essentially. Yes, you're right. We are a short stack of the people with still cards.
People who still have cards, right?
Yeah.
I feel like I need to re-raise here. I really do, and I know I'm going to be out of position.
Absolutely.
If somebody calls me, but I just don't think a call with king queen out of position in the small blind is the play. It's either fold or call, and I don't give this raise that much respect. It's either fold or raise. I don't feel like a call is in order here because I'm going to be out of position the rest of the way, and I'm shorter, so the guy's going to put pressure on me. So I'm going to raise here, and I don't like that 4K raise. I'm going to use the leverage that Howard Lederer wrote about, and I'm going to put the onus back on him. And I'm going to make it like 12, 10? No, maybe 12 or 14 maybe, because there's antes out there. There's a lot of dead money out there. And I really don't want the big blind to get frisky with me, which I know he's going to because you already told me he was a villain. But if I raise enough, I might make him reconsider trying to keep position on me. And then get the end of the gun to fold too. So I really feel like the optimal play here, the correct play, is to raise here. You know, we're already in the money. We're trying to get to the final table. And I think that the pattern that's been displayed so far, at least explained to us, would indicate that our hand is probably stronger and we should take advantage of that.
Yeah, certainly. This is a hand that I get in trouble with five-handed. I think it becomes a much bigger hand. Definitely, because I think it just seems to be automatic raising here. So if that's the case, we put in a decent raise, boom. If he was raising with air, boom, we take down a nice pot from the small blind, which is tough to do five-handed. And then we're good.
Yeah, I mean, there's 8,000 out there after this raise, right? Because there's five-handed, 200 ante at 1,000, and then small is 2,000. It makes it 2, and then a 2 makes it 4, and then 4 raises 8. So there's 8,000 out there already. If I make it, 12, 14, 15,000, he's got to call 11 to win, 23? So he's getting a little more than 2-1 on his money. You know, just to call, I don't know. He probably lets it go if it's not really an optimal hand. So maybe he doesn't. I don't know. But I think I'm going to make it like 15 or so.
The other thing, too, is interesting. I mean, this is one of the things where it's impossible to get this in a hand of the week, but I would have liked more information on the individual players and how they've been playing hands. Because there's also probably a case to be made, and I know this is going to sound very tight, but when I'm down in a five-handed situation in the money, this is kind of what we talked about in the main topic. I push my focus much more towards tournament strategy rather than poker strategy.
Yeah.
And if I can get a situation where I can get in this situation where I'm third in chips, if I can get a situation where I can get the two chip leaders in a hand together with no one else, that's an advantage, I think, for me. Because hopefully one of them will get crazy and knock the other one out, and then that's huge because that's one more spot that you move up. Two, you're taking on another threat, one more person that can take you out of this table. Of course, you move to the final table, so it's a little different now. And I'm not so much worried about one person getting twice the chips there because of the levels at this point. You know, it's somewhat immaterial eventually. So I really could, depending on how these players play, and again, I would need more information to do this, I could almost advocate folding here and letting those two people tangle and see what happens. But without any extra information, I think at this point, this is too good of a hand for us to pass up. Let's raise. Let's hopefully take it down here. If not, We'll put in a nice c-bet. Lots of flops can help us here, and continue to go from there.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. So we call. We decide to call. And the big blind calls as well too, and he says, "I know we're out of position here, but I'd like to just take a flop. King queen is a very strong hand at a five-handed table. Let's see what happens."
No, see, I don't like that at all. Oh, the other thing too is you really want to isolate the guy if you're going to play with someone. You want to have one player, not two. You've let the big blind in now with any two cards. Anything can happen now.
Maybe you have two people that can bankrupt you.
Yeah, yeah. Two chip leaders are going against you now. So I don't like that at all. If I'm going to play this hand, I'm either folding it or I'm raising it. I'm not calling.
I mean, unless our plan is to be very cautious and play king queen like we would at a fold table, you know, two pair or better, then maybe I'll call. And I guess we have enough chips. I mean,
yeah, I don't even like that either. If you're being cautious,
but that would have to be the strategy, right? There's no other reason to call at this point.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
If
you're thinking cautious, then just fold. You know, because why be out of position for the rest of the way with a trap hand? Just fold. But if you're going to play it aggressively. I wouldn't even think of being cautious at this point, because you're just going to screw yourself. And then the odds of flopping two pair is just, you're not getting the right odds with that call. So I would just let it go then if I'm going to be cautious.
Okay, we have 13,000 in the pot, and the flop is the five of diamonds, king of clubs, nine of hearts, and we are first to act with top pair.
Well, again, it's difficult to know what these people play like. I would bet out if I knew that they were weak and would fold, because I want to take that pot now without them catching up. But I would check if I knew that they would bet with nothing and then check raise them to get that bet. So I don't know what they play like. Generally, I would bet here, and I would probably bet. I guess it's a rainbow board, but there's still Jack 10. Queen Jack, those kind of hands that could hurt me on the turn. But I mean, I would probably bet this hand, and I would probably bet, you know, 12 grand. I mean, it's hard for me to know. If I knew these guys were definitely going to C bet, I might check and let him bet, you know, and then raise it. But if I have no idea how they play and I don't know what they're doing, which I don't, I'm probably going to bet out.
I'm not a big fan of the check raise, but I kind of think that's what I would go for in this position. I mean, we haven't shown any aggression. We're in the small blind, so we can have a wide variety of hands.
Yeah.
It's not a board that there's a lot of danger. I mean, you're right. I mean, there's possible straight draw, but so you know, if we end up checking around, I don't think we're giving up too much value or putting ourselves in too much peril. I would rather check here. Hopefully, one of these the initial aggressor will put in a bet and then check raise there, try to really push out the big blind and take it there. And then I've got a good enough hand that I can continue to lead at it for the rest of the hand. I'm a little worried about betting out right now, just because of how dry the board is, that we might continue to get these other people to call. And while we have top pair, our hand is still fairly vulnerable. And then we're going to be committed to keep firing here. I think we spring a bigger trap with a check raise here.
Yeah, if we knew that they were definitely bet and do the C bet thing, yeah. I mean, I would, like I said before, I would want to check raise. But I just don't know. If I don't know the players, and I general ABC would be bet your hand and protect it against a straight.
All right, well, our hero decides to check, and he says, "I check the flop basically because I never," in all caps, donk lead, although I do think that I have the best hand 7 of the time. The big blind checks, and the initial aggressor, who is under the gun, bets 6,255 units. And it's back to us. It's about half the pot.
Yeah. That smells weak to me. That smells pretty weak.
Seems like a standard C bet to me. I mean, this is where maybe I pop it to 20 because of my check raise thing. If I pop at the 20, then I'm at what I started at 50,000.
Yeah, so you'd have 30 left, so you're betting.
Yeah, so I mean, this is probably somewhere in the 15s. At some point where I don't want to pot commit myself, but I want to make a big enough bet here and I can shut it down.
Let me ask you this. If you bet 20, that's 40% of your stack.
Yeah.
You don't think that's already committed you? If
well,
somebody
yeah,
so
I'm thinking 20 did sound like a little big after I went back.
But you would normally usually raise a bet by 3 times. That's generally what you would do. So if you did
I guess I'm stuck almost, here. Either a min raise, which, you know, a min raise with stacks at this point is less offensive than a min raise early on in a tournament.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, our opponent min raised the
initial raise, you know. Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, I guess probably what I would do here is min raise. I mean, I guess the other part of this is I don't know whether I'm going to be able to get rid of this hand at this point. And that's probably a dicey thing to say with top pair, second kicker, out of position against the two players that can pull me out of this hand. But, you know, at this point, five-handed, I mean, hand values change a little bit. So I guess I'm not scared of pot committing myself. At the same time, it seems kind of crazy to go all in here.
Yeah, all in's a lot. And but that's the thing, though, is if you're betting almost 50% of your stack, then you should just shove. That's the thing. Yeah. It's so weird. And, you know,
so
if you're wrong,
you're
screwed.
Based on that, yeah, I guess I'm in race, as weird as it sounds. And I don't know. I don't know what options that gives me because, you know, if he shoves, then at that point, I guess if he shoves, we can get out and give him credit for something better and still have enough chips to play. I guess that's the only real advantage to the mid-race here.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, anything else, I think we're just going to get it in at some point and hope for the best if it gets to that point.
Yeah, you could get away from it with a min-raise because that would only be 13,000 and you still have 37,000 left, which is plenty. When it's 1-2, your M is, 9 and some 9 point something. So you still have plenty of... At that point, you'd still have plenty of time to stick around. So you could get away from a min raise. So that might work. I just don't know if it's enough to get the big blind out or to get this guy out. I don't know if you want him out or not. I think you do, but maybe you don't.
Well, yeah. I mean, at this level of tournament, I'm happy just winning pots. I don't need to necessarily felt someone or to this point cripple them. Obviously, I want to get as much value as I can all the time, but... you know, I think you get a lot of value by just winning pots without going to showdown this late in the tournament.
I think a min raise is a good idea in the fact that, let's say the big blind is setting us up here and trapping us with something, like a set. You know, it's very possible that he had, you know, fives, and now he's got a set of them, and he's checking, thinking that the check raise, not realizing you were going to come alive. So if this guy bets the first guy, the under the gun, and then we check raise to min raise, if the big blind now shoves or does something crazy, we can get away from it. We know, okay, he checked.
Absolutely.
And now rechecked our check raise, or recheck raised our check raise. This is getting confusing. You know, then like we've avoided that problem. You know, so I like the min raise. I think. I mean, I don't know if I would have min raised in the moment, just because it's like, hey, I got top pair, top kicker. I'm shorter than these two guys. I'm looking to make the final table with a big stack, and I don't respect either one of their hand ranges. I'm just going to get it all in here. I may have done that. I don't know. I may have bet out too. So I don't know. But putting his position and having some time to think about it, min raise sounds pretty interesting. Somewhere around a min raise.
Right.
Yeah, sounds pretty interesting.
All right. Well, our hero decides to call and he says, once again, I think I have the best hand here. This could be a decent board to C bet where he should be doing it with 100% of his range. And the big blind calls as well.
Man, you know, they always say that calling is losing poker. And I just have a feeling we're going to lose this hand, and we have done nothing but be passive and let them just stick around for their prices for reasonable amounts, and you'd have no idea what these guys have for cards now. You can't even put them on ranges, really.
At this point, at this point now that I got the pair of kings, I really want this to be heads up at worst.
Yep.
You know, I really don't want this big blind sticking around. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely had to raise somewhere there. I'm sure in the heat of moment I would have raised too much and committed myself, but, you know, we have the luxury of being on the hand of the week and being able to slow down, and I think the mid-race is the way to go. But I definitely think you got to raise and, you know, try to drive this big blind out or get him to poke him with a stick and find out what he has.
Agreed. I don't like passive play. When you commit to a hand, you need to take control of it at some point, and we haven't done that. Now we're going to turn. People are going to see 4 cards now for basically the price they wanted to set. And you did nothing to control this hand, and you have no idea what they have.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is we're looking at a pot of about 32K now, and we're down to, what, 845 or so? So it's a little bit more than our stack's a little bit more than the pot. I mean, we're getting to the point now where the next bet's going to be pretty, it's not going to be 6,000, it's going to be 25,000.
Right, that's something else you always have to keep in mind, and no limit hold'em is... It's not what bet it is now. It's what the later streets are going to be. Can you afford it, and will you call it then? If you will, then shove now. Put the pressure on them.
All right, so here it says the board is fairly dry with not a lot of draws out there. He says, well, I guess none. Of course, we jack 10, I think, is a decent possibility. But,
right.
But he says, once again, this guy is good and has the ability to float in spots like this. He's still talking about the big blind. All right, so like I said, the turn is just a hair shy of 32,000, and the turn is the four of diamonds. So our board now is five of diamonds, king clubs, nine of hearts, four of diamonds. Shouldn't change too much, and we are first to act again.
One thing I want to mention is when he says float. Yeah, it's one thing to float one opponent when you have position to steal it away, but when you have somebody acting behind you who is the aggressor pre-flop, you're not floating anymore. You're overcalling, really. I mean, you're not really floating. I mean, unless you're positive the guy's going to fold behind you if the guy ahead of you checks and you bet. But really, he's not even really floating you yet because he's got somebody behind him to act. So I think this four of diamonds did nothing. How could it? If somebody had pocket fours and they stuck around, then they're playing less optimal poker and more power to them that they got lucky with a two-outer to beat us. So, you know, that call does scare me. Why is he calling? Maybe on a draw, but maybe he's trapping me. I don't know. But the way we've played it up till now, the way Keith's played it, you know, I don't know if I'm comfortable betting with that call behind me now and all that money out there. You know, I don't know if I'm comfortable betting now. I really am not comfortable. So, I don't know. Maybe I check. Because what am I going to bet? There's 30-something in the pot. If I bet half that pot, 16, that's, you know, or that's like 16 or so. That's like a third of my stack. And then if somebody shoves, do I really want to risk all that money on one pair after all this when I could have done it earlier and known I was going to see all five cards and put pressure on people? Now, you know what I mean? I just don't feel right betting out. I know you were talking about betting out earlier. I don't know if you – can you still bet out the guy calling behind you like that?
Well, I mean, here's the problem now with the pot size in our chip stack is any reasonable bet that we're going to make, we might as well shove. And which I guess at this point is not a bad thing. I mean, be happy to pick up 32,000 and maybe we get a call and we're good. If we bet anything less than anything that commits ourselves, it doesn't do anything, I don't think.
No, you're right. Because normally you'd bet about 2/3 here, not even half, right? You'd probably bet 2/3 of the pot, maybe.
Yeah. And we're just going to call it. And obviously, I shouldn't say it doesn't do anything. I mean, it gets more money in the pot, and if we have the best hand, that's great if it holds up. But then we got to fade another card. I mean, then we have to start thinking what people have. Two players are not going to call our bet here with absolutely nothing.
Right.
They have to have something. And we don't have a lot. I mean, we have top pair, but there's a gajillion cards that could come on the river that could beat us.
A gajillion?
A gajillion, yes. I actually did the math.
Boy, it's hard to have enough money in the pot to cover those pot odds. Is there a gajillion in the pot? Because I want to know if I got the right odds.
It's a slightly smaller bet than betting for your life. all right, so our hero bets out 12,555, which is about a little bit more than a third of the pot.
Yeah,
and I guess this is what I was saying here at this point. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to fold here. Maybe. We think we're good, and we're just going to run the odds that our hand's going to hold up on the river, and we're just trying to squeeze a little bit more money out of folks. If that's the case, great. That's a great bet. I'm just a little worried that we're so vulnerable now here.
Yeah, and remember, you're doing this against the two largest stacks at your five-handed table. These guys, if these guys were willing to just call $6,000, and then there was 12 more put in the pot after that, they're probably going to be willing to call 12 too and make the hand that you don't want them to make or whatever. So what you always have to think to yourself, what's the point of betting here and what's the point of the amount I'm betting? Why am I doing this? Why am I betting? Why are you betting 12,000 here? Is it to get people out of the pot? Is it to put more money in the pot because you think you got the best hand? I don't know. I don't see the point of betting here, really. I really think a check to control the size of the pot might be your best bet here.
All right, so the big blind calls and the under the gun folds.
Now he's floating you.
So we go to the river, heads up. Pot now is just shy of 57K, and the river is the ace of clubs. So our final board is five of diamonds, king of clubs, nine of hearts, four of diamonds, ace of clubs. Can't say we're ecstatic about seeing an ace.
Every street he did the opposite or close to what I didn't want to do, so I don't know even how to react now. The ace stinks. You know, I don't know what this guy has. Was he really floating us the whole time with an ace and just hoping to take it away? It's pretty ballsy to do with the under the gun guy still behind you to act. So,
right.
I don't know if he's floating or not. He could be. He could be just waiting to steal it from you, but I don't know. And that ace is scary. He could have been sticking around with ace 10 or ace 9, had a pair of nines with an ace kicker. Who knows? I mean, he could have a draw and get there.
It's kind of tough, actually, for me to believe in this situation that people would just call a min raise with an ace, any ace.
Yeah.
You know, I know better players can probably get away with that because they know weaker players like me are going to realize that. But I would think if either one of us had an ace, that we would have re-raised, I mean, five-handed. Why not, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm a little less concerned about the ace. So, you know, unless he's got some kind of other king two pair, but I think he would have been more active. In a very odd way, I actually feel more confident now. But again, I don't think I would have gotten myself in the situation, so I don't know really what to do about that confidence other than I'm probably going to try to set a price here, maybe make the same bet.
Well, let me ask you this.
Rather than check and let him set a price for me.
At this point, I usually try to go back through the hand and put him on a range a little more specific. Would he play pocket fives the way he's played it? Sure, there's nothing to worry about all the way through the turn. Mm-hmm. There's nothing really to worry about. Jack 10, Queen Jack maybe, but when the turn got there and it didn't, he can get away with simply calling again.
But here's the thing, with a chip leader set mine with a pair this late in the tournament, wouldn't pocket fives be almost like a set of aces?
You know, it's not even just set mining to me. I mean, I don't think when you got the guy second in chips, while you're the chip leader, raising under the gun with pocket fives, you're not going to fold them. I don't think you're going to re-raise them.
But
this guy can crush you. You went from being 71,000 chip leader to having, you know, a massive amount of your stack gone because you re-raised this guy and then he outplayed you the rest of the way or whatever. You're tangling with the biggest stack at your table.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the big blind.
I know the big blind has 71. I'm talking about the big blind facing the under the gun player.
Right.
If he has pocket fives, he's going to be tangling. If he re-raises like their aces or whatever, he's going to be tangling with a 62,000 chip stack, and he does, that's the last thing he wants to do.
But again, go back to where our discussion was. I mean, I don't think at the beginning any of us put anybody on hands at that point. We just thought this is just a standard, you know, hey, let's raise, and no one has anything. I pick up the blind. So just the same reason that we considered raising with king-queen, I would raise with pocket fives.
Yeah, I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would raise with fives. King queen, I think, even though it's statistically less than 5-5, I think it's a much more powerful hand than 5-5 to re-raise with. I feel like, and plus you've already got the caller, so now
it's
with 5-5.
It's a less vulnerable hand. That's the other reason. I mean, fives. I mean, what do you do with fives after the flop?
Right.
Unless you hit this kind of flop. All the more reason to raise a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, this is what, a $15 tournament? You know, I mean, I usually play $60 to $100 tournaments, and I see chip leaders play these fives pretty aggressively in this situation a lot. I mean, I certainly could be wrong here, but I'm not saying I'm dismissing. I mean, again, we're just putting on ranges here, but.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're trying to go through hands,
at this point, it's like
what's the point of betting?
Five
is
really the only hand I'm really worried about here, I think.
I just don't know the point of betting. I don't know the point of betting here. I'm trying to figure out why I would bet, and I'm trying to go through the hands that he would possibly have.
The reason I would bet is to set the price, because here's the problem, I think. Regardless of what we have or he has, if we check here, we're opening him up to trying to push us off this hand, right?
Right.
And he's got a lot of chips, and he's got the leverage now. He knows if he puts us all in and we call, we're out of the tournament. I would be shocked if he didn't try to put us all in here, if he checked. this thing. I just don't think he would think that we're that that crafty to check an ace on the river and we've come this far. So he's going to put us all in. I would rather not be all in here, not knowing where we are because of the way we played the hand. So, you know, maybe I put in another 12,000 and maybe he calls that and we're lucky with our king. I don't know.
All right, well, we'll do this for me then, okay? You're
but
on the river.
I'd be all in here.
You're on the river. You're actually in this situation. What hands does this guy have? What are you putting him on right now because of the way he played this hand? Tell me what the big blind, the way he played this hand from beginning to end, has for a hand. You tell me that.
I think Jack-Queen, Jack-10. It could be a single pair of fives or nines with something else. I mean, you know, he had to call a min raise. So really, you could have a lot of things. It could be a lot of kings that we have beat.
Okay, so in my situation,
I guess generally speaking,
all we have is a bluff catcher. Then is what you're telling me. Then because we couldn't beat anything except for crappy hands.
Yeah, but crappy hands are entirely possible here, unfortunately.
Yeah. So. You want to bet into a guy that's only going to call you or raise you with a better hand? Or is he going to raise you bluffing you and then you're going to get away from it because he knows how passively you play?
No, if he's got one of these lesser hands, I think he's going to call us.
So you think if he had a pair of fives or the rag, he'd call you for 15 grand?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to stick with
But really, the reason I'm doing it is to set the price. I mean, again, he could have absolutely nothing. Let's say he has Jack-10 or Jack-Queen, which I think are very likely. We check here. There's no reason that he wouldn't try to push us all in here.
Well, here's the deal. If he has Jack-Queen, and you're pretty confident that he has that hand, then you want him to make a stab at it. And then you want to call him because you're confident what he has. So if you're not confident, then why are you betting? If you're confident, then you could bet and then, or you could check and then hope he makes a stab at it because you're confident. If you're not, I don't want to set a price that I'm going to have to throw away for nothing anyway if he raises me there. You know what I mean? Whereas if I check, maybe he'll bet 15 and try to get it out of me, and that's what I was willing to bet before. And I call.
I guess what I'm saying is that I'm going to set the price that I'm willing to pay any price, but I'd rather not have to pay that price. So at this point, the way we've played this hand, we've come this far, I think it's going to be hard for me to fold here.
So if he shoves, you're going to call anyway.
I think I'm going to have to. But I would rather not. I'd rather see this to the end for 12,000 rather than the entire stack. But again, I mean, I wouldn't have played this hand like this way.
No, I know. Neither would I. No, so, from the beginning, I wouldn't have played it this way. But
it's a tough situation that we're in now. So, and obviously, our hero plays differently than we do. So, you know, I'm not criticizing him, but he's probably in a better situation to understand how to play in this situation because he got himself in this situation.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think I would have got myself in this situation.
Well, here's the deal:
I could have got myself in a worse situation.
if you're willing to call your entire stack, then I have no problem checking because no matter what he bets, I'm going to call it anyway. So maybe he won't bet anything, and I'll save all the money. No matter what, I'm going to have to call. True. So why not just check and call? And I mean, if that's the way you're thinking, to me, I wouldn't mind checking here. Let him set the price. If I think he has a draw, then he just took a stab at a pot that he couldn't win, and I got him to bluff at it, and I won with my top pair, second kicker. If he's way better than me and he shoves, then more power to him because the only thing I could think of is pocket fives beats us. Maybe ace five or ace nine, and now he's gotten there. Because you were saying any five or any nine rag or anything. Because if he had ace five, he might not have raised preflop, but now he's got a piece of it. You know, he might have ace nine middle pair had a piece of it. And then at the turn, it wasn't that expensive for him to call. So then on the river, he hit his aces up, and now you're screwed. So it's tough. I feel like a check's in order because that way he may just try to milk it and get something out of you, and then you'll get a showdown and still be alive and not shove. He may not shove. You know? And if he does shove, maybe you said before you're more confident with that ace. You were more confident. I don't know how I feel about that ace, to be honest.
I mean, again, it's one of these things where I'm just... oh, man, you made me lose my train of thought.
No, there. I'm sorry. I talked too long.
No, I think the big thing for me, the tipping point for me here is this chip stack. In that, if it's any other opponent, I don't think he's going to try to put us all in. But I would think this guy knows, hey, we came alive weirdly on the turn. Now the ace comes and now we check. You know what? I'm going to make this guy think that I have an ace and I stuck around for an ace, which is a very likely holding, right?
Yeah.
And he's not going to want to call off his chips with a king at this point. And I can afford to do that because I'm the chip leader. Whereas if anybody else, I wouldn't think that they would be that bold.
Okay, I'm dying to know what happened.
All right, so we check our opponent bets 31,000.
Yeah, he just basically puts us in.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm calling. Because I just feel like, to be honest, that's hand of the week, so he's probably got pocket fives, but or something like that, or he hit his two pair on the end or something. But really, I don't know. I feel like that bet, why does it have to be a shove? Why does he have to put me all in at the end? Is it just an intimidation thing? If he really wanted those chips from me, wouldn't he have bet like 15? You know, does he really want to intimidate
me?
Yeah, so I'm going to call. Screw it.
All right. Well, I don't think our hero screwed it, but he did decide to call. Now he says, I understand he can have a lot of ace five, ace nine hands that just made two pair. Could be slow playing a set, but I think he would raise that when I lead the turn. I agree there. I'm not doing that with air. I also think he needs to represent the ace just as often as he has. And I call and I'm right, and I'm chip leader and crushing the FT. What's that?
Final table.
Crushing the final table.
Yeah.
So we do make the call, and our opponent turns over king of diamonds, seven of diamonds.
Yes!
Woohoo! Chip leader in first place when it's all said and done.
Yes, we won a hand. That's the one hand of the year that will win a hand of the week. All right. Well, I made the right call, and you made the right call. We just got there in a lot of different ways. That's good.
And he said, okay, he said that he posted his hand in a couple other places, and some people mentioned to three bet preflop. Any thoughts there? I think we talked about that.
Yeah,
says, I just don't want to three bet fold king, queen at a final table. And I don't think I'm calling a four bet out of position.
But yeah, but given the information he gave us, I would have three bet too. We talked about that right away. Three bet right away. That king seven goes away. Under the gun, probably didn't have anything. Clearly, he might have had that ace, but he wouldn't have gotten to that point because you would have three bet him and then fired at him after the flop and he'd have folded. So, This worked out, but you can't be results oriented. You know what I mean? You have to think optimal strategy. And optimal strategy to me was a raise preflop, a three bet.
Yeah, I think we would have got the same spot with less aggravation.
Yeah.
Playing it the way we would have played, right? I guess if we would have three bet preflop, maybe the king seven disappears, and then we don't make as much. But let's assume that we didn't three bet. Once we get into it, I don't think he's going anywhere with this king. Seven.
Which is weird.
And we wouldn't have been kind of in this pickle at the end.
We wake up and bet out on the turn, and the guy just calls with king seven, thinking his kings are good, and which it could be good, but why would we have bet out after calling a raise preflop, then checking the flop, calling it, and then betting out, donk betting? Why does he think his king is good there? So, all right, interesting hand. We had a pretty good discussion about it. I didn't think we were. I thought it was going to be pretty straightforward, but that was interesting.
All right, Keith, we appreciate you sending that in, and we remind everyone to send your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we're going to send you something great like we are, Keith, a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. You can pick up your own decks in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
All right, good show. Differences between tournaments and cash games. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
See you at the tables.
Antiup is a production of antiupmagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.